1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 225. But what does it mean? Reading between the lines with Brian Evenson. Readings by the author Brian Evenson. Session chaired by Jason Matthew Smith. This is a 60-minute session taped on a 90-minute tape, so the second half of side two will be blank.
Okay, I think we're about ready to begin. Welcome to session number 225. I'd like to remind everyone that admittance to this session is by ticket or pre-printed name tag. So if you have neither ticket nor name tag, please go to the registration table. That helps ensure Sunstone's financial solvency. There will be a book signing. Brian will sign his book, Prophets and Brothers, between 12:45 and 2:15 today. It's right across the hall in the multipurpose room. We will also have his book, his books, Prophets and Brothers and The Den of Celestial Birds, on sale. There will be a time for questions following the reading. And now, Brian Evenson is the author of three books of short stories, Altman's Tongue, The Den of Celestial Birds, and Prophets and Brothers, as well as a forthcoming novel, Father of Lies. He is the winner of an NEA Fellowship and an O. Henry Award. He lives in Stillwater, Oklahoma, and teaches at Oklahoma State University. Ladies and gentlemen, Brian Evenson.
I'm going to do a couple of things today. I have a new novel that's coming out, which I have the advance proofs for, called Father of Lies. And I'll read, I think, some from that. I have never read from it before in a public session, so I think I'll end up doing that near the end. I'm also going to read a story called The Prophets, which is in this chapbook, Prophets and Brothers, which Sunstone has for, I think, $4.50 or some remarkably cheap price. And that's probably what I'll do, and then I'll hopefully talk a little bit about art, and then let you ask any questions you have, and then we can go from there. And the dog, about a man who decides to bless his dog, give his dog a priesthood blessing, and strange things happen when that happens. He gets bit, among other things. And then there's also a story called Sanctified in the Flesh, where people have a breakdown in the car, and someone stops, and one of the people who have the breakdown is convinced that the people who are stopping must be the three Nephites. They turn to be something quite different. But The Prophets was a story that I wrote, I suppose, partly in response to something I heard a lot when I was living in Utah County, both growing up and then back when I was when I came back to teach at BYU for a little while. I had a lot of people who would tell me, first when President Benson was ill, that the church was being run by liberals because President Benson was ill, and that if only he was well, then things would be a lot better and we could get back to the real faith. And then also, once he was dead, I heard people, lament the fact that he was dead and wish that we were back there, because he was, he had the right attitudes. Now, I have nothing against President Benson. I think he was, good in many ways. But this was just taking that metaphor and making it literal, playing around with it. Steve Benson, Ezra Taft Benson's grandson, my father gave him a copy of this story, and he thought it was okay, so I hope you will too. We'll see. In a holy vision, the Lord came to and told me to buy myself a shovel and employ it in a righteous use, so I went next door and borrowed one off Boyd Laswell and awaited further instruction. I took to pondering and praying, striving to divine what God might have me accomplish by means of a shovel. I hauled the shovel through my comings and goings, slung upon my shoulders. I did some walking and standing, praying to God to prompt me where to dig, though I didn't even know if digging was for what the shovel was intended. Boyd Laswell saw me at it one noon and came after me shouting at me to render him back his shovel. I tried to dissuade him with, "Leave off, God has confiscated this shovel." But he knocked me off my feet and took it. He is not properly parceled over to the promptings of the Spirit, as am I. I had a few deep and easy nights, then the same fitful vision came a work at me. A few nights that had harrowed me through, though, and I began to think that if I kept paying the dream no heed, I was on course to hell. So I got up in the stark of night and scuffed my way down to Central Hardware and broke the door window out with a garbage can lid. Would have gone in after a shovel, too, but God showed me the glints of the dog's teeth as he waited to devour me. So I went home again and in a little while fell asleep. Woke up an hour later with my mouth dry and sores on my lips, a vision of the shovel still running about my head. So I snuck on over to Boyd's and snipped a crowbar from the back of his truck, then pried the lock off a shed door. I'm no thief. All I took was the shovel. Would have left money for it, too, but figured it better to let God reward Boyd in his own way. I kept with my study of God's holy scriptures, kept Boyd's shovel sharp-edged and skinned of dirt, my mind sharp, too, God having made it so. Pretty soon I began to fathom that the scripture I read and the church I embraced pursued divergent paths. I read the scriptures 100 times before, but had never known the truth until then. Boyd came over twice a day telling me to give him back his goddamn shovel and come mend his shed. I kept telling him I didn't take his shovel and I didn't do nothing to his shed door, but the devil made him so as not to be satisfied. All that was took was a shovel, he said. It's you, Verl, plain as day. He tried to bluster his way around my house looking for the shovel, but I wouldn't let him get far. Hit him on the back of the head with both fists when he wasn't looking, then dragged him out on out again. Most of the time after that, we just stood truce on the porch, Boyd waiting to see if I would let something slip concerning his shovel, and me voicing out the fact of the Spirit I was fast in the process of discovering, the church's apostasy. Boyd was given over to regaining his shovel and did not fully take my words in, did not ever say a thing unless the shovel was involved. Before taking to bed, I would always pray God to let me know what was to be done with the shovel. I likewise prayed in rising and added to my morning prayer as well for God to make Boyd leave me the hell alone. Look, Boyd said, after a few weeks, you can keep the shovel. All I want to know is that you were the one who took it. I didn't take it, Boyd, I said. I don't have your shovel. He just shook his head and went off. If that isn't a prayer answered, I don't know what is. I started reading, and plus to the scriptures, the history of the church, the discourses of all the presidents and prophets. Didn't take me long to see where the church had gone wrong. It was so easy to see, I couldn't figure out why nobody else hadn't fallen sensible to it yet. The way it was laid out to me, Ezra Taft was the last real president of the church worth his salt. All the ones since him were liberals, people who the Lord had inflicted upon the church for its wickedness. Ezra T., though, he was a good John Bircher, who saw with a clear eye the importance of our founding fathers' constitution. He knew our nation to be ruined by the evils of the federal government. He saw like it was in broad daylight the conspiracy of the New World Order. And to top it off, he supported gardening and self-sufficiency. But by the time he was the president, even he was too old and sick and got kept incognito and shuttered up by liberals. What we needed, I figured, was a return to the full-starched priesthood wielders of the past, a return to the original prophets, the church's secret formula to success. Had that on my mind, was concerned for the welfare of God's church, for keeping it on the holy track. It took me all day thinking about and praying for the Lord's help for the church, so I stopped going off to work and spooled myself away inside the house. I took to sleeping through the day and carrying the shovel around the streets at night, Boyd being asleep, until the police cruisers took to pulling up alongside me and serving me hell. After that, I took mostly to staying in. The evenings, Boyd came by so much that I started letting him off the porch and into the front room. Sometimes he would ask with about 1/3 of a heart after the shovel, but pretty soon he wore himself out on that topic altogether. My former employer came over a few times and knocked hard enough to rattle the door in its frame. But me and Boyd just stayed quiet, and pretty soon he went away for good. I offered Boyd the fruits of my study. I told him how liberals had seized the reins of the church, leading the horses to run full bore away from God. What we need, Boyd, I said, is a return to the prophets of the past. But Boyd would not admit yea or nay, nor even pay attention. That's how he was. This is the second part. Then one night I figured the vision's meaning through and through. I stood up and slung the shovel athwart my shoulder and walked over to knock on Boyd's door. A few minutes of pounding and he came to the door mumbled-eyed, his holy underwear in shameless view to all the world. Didn't seem too pleased to see me, but after all, he didn't know what I was there to see him about. My shovel, he said, when he saw me carrying it. Get dressed, Boyd, I said. We're driving to Idaho. He sat looking at me looking through me a long time like I was stupid or something. Shaking his head, he went back inside and closed the door. I opened the door and invited myself on in. Boyd was back in his bed already. I shook him awake a little. Loan me your truck, Boyd, I asked. Let me sleep, he groaned. I asked after his keys, but he wouldn't tell me or didn't know what I wanted. I got on the bed and shook him a little more, but that didn't do anything for him neither. I looked for his keys on the kitchen counter. There were some hooks on the wall by the back door, but nothing in the way of keys to hang from them. Taking Boyd's trousers from the living room floor, I found the keys in a front pocket. I found his wallet, too, back pocket, and figured he would not begrudge me a few measly dollars for gas. Boyd, I said, I'm taking your truck to Idaho. Boyd didn't say anything, so I took the truck and left. I drove 3 hours to Idaho, God's country, considering God's words the whole way. Got there an hour before the sun up, the sky threatening light, then drove up and down the town until I stumbled onto the graveyard. I walked about a bit, the dew clinging to the toes of my boots, until I started to see the Honorable Benson name slung all about the headstones. I walked down through them until I found notice of the prophet Ezra Taft and then set to digging. Took me about 2 seconds to recognize digging with a shovel was a waste of time. I left the shovel by the headstone and took a thinking walk around the graveyard, trying not to walk on anybody. Near the back fence I found a digger, the keys in it, just as if God had placed it there for my use, which in fact he had. Climbing in, I started it and threw the gear in. I drove back to Ezra Taft's grave as best I could manage, clipping down no more than a few headstones. I started in digging, mastering the trade as I went. First thing, I almost tipped the bastard over backwards, but then I got it figured in and took a few gouges out of the ground, dumping them wherever the scoop had a mind to dump, which was sometimes back in the same hole. Took the hole down until dawn was near breaking and I had scraped and creased the lid of the casket, then scrambled down on my own to finish off with Boyd's shovel. When I got the lid up, I could see the old prophet's face perfectly preserved for a moment, privately collapsing as the air struck it. I had to hang my face over the side of the grave a little and breathe, but then I thought maybe this was God's test for me. Getting down there, I pushed at the body a smidgen, seeing if the bones were integumented together sturdy enough. They seemed to be so I grabbed him by the shirt and lifted him out. I shook the bugs out best I could, then got them all secured under a tarp in the back of Boyd's truck. I got back in myself, drove. When I pulled the truck back in around lunchtime, Boyd was sitting on a lawn chair in the driveway, arms crossed. "Where you been?" he said. "Idaho." "Shit, Verl, you took my truck all the way to Idaho?" "You told me to," I told him, handing back his keys. "You volunteered it." He threw his weight around some more, then suddenly calmed down and started sniffing his way around. "What's that smell?" he said. "Nothing," I said. He went to the back of the truck and looked under the tarp, went white once he saw the bundle there. "Jesus," he said, "what's this all about?" "Don't worry your pretty head none, Boyd. That's the prophet. I'm saving the church is all." "You take him back," he said, "now." Boyd, he could be pretty stupid sometimes. "I can't take it back," I said. He started whimpering. "Get it out of my truck," he hollered, "or I call the police." "Sure," I said. "Hey, lend me a hand, Boyd." He wouldn't help me, though. Just went into the house and me after a little while following him in. "Going to look awful funny to the police," I told him, "you with the body slung in back of your truck." "I didn't do nothing," he said. "Don't matter," I said. "What matters is what it looks like. And what it looks like is awful funny." I didn't wait for an answer, but went back to my own house and clapped the door closed like I was angry or something. It didn't take him long to be coming after me. "All right," he said. "I'll help you get it out." I didn't know quite what to do with him, so I told Boyd just to lean him against the garage wall and maybe brace him up a little in a corner so he wouldn't turn and yaw over. I sent Boyd home, then sat there in the garage looking at the fellow. He didn't look like no prophet, flesh mortally gone and what was left merling on the bones. I wondered if maybe I had gotten the wrong Benson on my hands instead of Ezra T. But no, the stone had read Ezra Taft all right. I tried to stand him up so he would stay afoot, but the body was not exactly cooperating and wanted to stay board stiff, hands to sides. I leaned him against the wall, then thought it over and stepped next door. "Got some wire?" I asked Boyd. "What's to keep me from calling the police now that he's out of my truck and in your garage?" "Neighborly spirit," I said. "By God," he said, "I'll call them. Just fetch me the wire," I said. He went out to the shed, me following, and fished out a coil of solid wire. I took the coil and slipped it over my arm. "I wouldn't call them," I said. "God don't like it." "God?" he said. "I'll figure out a way to make them think you were in on it," I said. "By the way, thanks for the wire." I spun two turns over the garage rafter and started hooking the wire to the body, but there was no easy place to hook it on, so I went back to Boyd's. "Got a drill?" I asked. He started to turn, then hesitated. "I don't even want to know," he said. Pretty soon I had him wire slung and standing, more or less. I had him looking sleek as he could in a dark pinstripe suit that I borrowed from Boyd's closet while he was asleep. I decided to see what I could do about making him look a little perkier. I went into the house and got some of the supplies my wife had left a few years back when she had seen fit to leave me so suddenly for no worthwhile or explicable reason. There was some bright neon red lipstick and some peach-colored powder with a puff and some mascara and then a few other supplies that I didn't even know what part of the body to rub with. I started with the lipstick because I thought it would be hard to go wrong. You've got the lips, you've got the lipstick. Seems pretty simple. The problem was that here we didn't have the lips. I had to make do with what little flesh was left and color in on the teeth for the rest. Then I went in and got some tissue like I had seen my wife do, and then I pressed it against the lips like I had seen her do. The peach stuff I just kind of powdered all over with until his face looked like it was coated with pollen. The mascara I finally gave over on because I couldn't see the point of making eyes look bigger that weren't even there in the first place. I went inside and found my spare reading glasses and smeared the lenses with Vaseline. I put them on the prophet and he looked good enough, better anyway, almost penetrating, with the eye holes gone uncanny through the Vaseline. I couldn't help but calling Boyd over for a look. He didn't want to come, but I kept threatening to turn myself in and take him with me, so finally he shuffled over. "Jesus Christ," he said when he saw the prophet, "you've gone crazy, Verl." I shook my head. "I'm the only sane one of the bunch," I said. "You got to get this body out of here," he said. "Like hell," I said. "This here's the prophet come to lead the church back to the track." He kept calling me crazy until he was tired out of saying it, but I just stuck to the truth and kept telling him about the dream of the shovel and the steps of how I had gotten from a shovel to having a dead prophet, the last true prophet, I told him, in my garage. I used God's logic on him. Boyd just shook his head and looked sad about his life and maybe about my own. Deep down, he was a compassionate person, Boyd, even though he was basically as dumb as a post. That was the beauty of him and why I wanted to take him along on the path to salvation. Suffer the little children, if you know what I mean. "I'm going home," he said. "But Boyd," I put it to him, "you're a churchgoer. Don't you want to save the church?" "You do what you want," he said. "I don't want to hear anything about it." I followed Boyd back home, and before he could shut the door, I got my foot wedged in. "It's me, Boyd," I said. "Let me in." "Like hell," said Boyd. "Boyd," I said, "all I want is one more thing from you, and then I'll leave you alone forever." He thought that went over an hour, stamping on my toes in the meantime. But when he saw I wasn't going to let off easy, he started to crumble. "What is it?" he asked.
Just come tell me how he looks for once. I don't need to see him again to tell you he looks like hell. Last thing ever, I said. Promise, he asked. Promise, I said. He looks like hell, said Boyd. You mean it? I don't know how you did it, but you made him look worse, Boyd said. What you got to do now is get him back into the ground as soon as possible. He's going to lead the church, Boyd. Like hell he is, said Boyd. I'm going to raise him from the dead, I replied, which was the truth. I'm going home. I'm telling you the truth, Boyd, I said. Don't believe me and you're destined for hell fire. He shook his head and walked out. I mean it, Boyd, I called after him. God needs you. I went to bed, but like hell could I sleep. Kept having dreams about the prophet in my garage. In my dream, he was begging me to hurry, and God seconding him. I got out of bed and made some chicory, me being the sort who, because of his religious knowings, doesn't drink strong drinks like coffee, even though that is what I mainly want to drink all the time. I took my chicory out into the garage and sat on the steps looking at the body. I set the cup down and started turning around the body, circling around it and thinking. Then once I got around behind it and I felt like I had the holy power coursing through me, I put my hands on the head and blessed it to rise up and walk and be alive. Then I stepped back. I waited for the prophet to stand and walk, but he did nothing of the kind, just kept hanging there by the wires. I decided that maybe a body dead and buried and in the ground for as long as that and all made up like that might need some surprise or some kind of jump start. So I kept on crouching down and hiding behind him, then leaping out yelling, "Rise up and walk! Rise up and walk!" It seemed like a good idea at first, but after a few hours the idea didn't seem so good to me anymore. But God knew I had tried, so for once he let me get some sleep. In the morning it was all the same things and me trying to figure out how to get the prophet onto his feet again so as to show us where the church went wrong and started back where it would go right instead. I thought maybe if I sprayed him down with a hose first, that might help matters. But what happened was the hose just spread what was left of his skin all over the garage. I blessed and anointed what was left of him every 5 minutes or so to rise up and walk, but he was stubborn for death and wasn't having none of it. I kept trying to surprise him, but he wasn't interested in that either. Around nightfall, nervous from the dreams about to come my way, I called it quits. I made my way inside to think the problem through with all my fund of logic. But it wasn't the sort of problem that would give over easy to logic. Once that came evident, I got out God's holy word, which had never led me wrong before, and opened the pages and looked for wisdom therein. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Maybe, I thought, this was a message from God directly to me. But I've come to think that it is better not to act until confirmation comes. So I kept flipping my way through all the holy books until after 7 or 8 false starts, I came upon the real one. For the word of the Lord is truth, and whatsoever is truth is light, and whatsoever is light is spirit. I had read that one 100 times before, but it felt like God had had his prophets put it in there just for me to find at that moment, so I could go about saving the church. This is the last section, final section. Boyd had locked the front door, but one of the windows was open a little, and the screen popped right off in my hands. He was in bed, though it was only a little past midnight, so I shook him awake. He just about had a coronary to hear him talk. He wasn't so happy about me showing up, but you could always count on Boyd not to hold a grudge long. "Still got that generator, Boyd?" I asked once he had calmed down. "You can't borrow it," he said. "Let me sleep." I went out of his bedroom and rummaged through the house a little, but could not find the generator anywhere. Tried Boyd's garage. Then I took the crowbar out of Boyd's truck again and pried the new door off the shed. It was a little better door than the first one, but it didn't make any difference in the long run. The generator wasn't there, but there was an orange utility cord and 2 spools of bare wire, and these I took back to my own garage. I worked the wire into one of the cord's positive sockets and then the second wire into the negative socket. The hole for grounding I just left like it was. Then I wound both spools of wire crisscross around the prophet's body and twisted them together once I ran out of them. I plugged the cord in, and the first thing it did that I saw was make the prophet start to hiss and smoke, though he weren't dry enough to catch flame. Then the wires on him started to glow red, and the extension cord was hot enough that the plastic started to melt too. I was going to pull it out, but I didn't want to have burning plastic all over my palm, so instead I ran into the house and opened the fuse box and saw the pennies spanning the gaps were glowing red hot as well. I ran into the kitchen to find something to pry the pennies free with, but by that time all the sockets in the house were spitting sparks and such. And then from the garage came a big flash and everything went dead. I took a flashlight out of the pantry and had a look around. Most of the sockets were black with the smell coming out of them. When I opened the fuse box, the top penny was melted down over the other pennies and fuses, and all of it burst apart and looking none too pretty. I'd never seen the like, and as I looked at it, I started to think it meant something, or perhaps was a sign of some sorts. Perhaps that God liked what I was doing and was telling me to keep it up. And then I began to wonder, since all this had happened in the house, about what had happened in the garage. I went over to Boyd's and stared at in his plate glass window. He was sitting in front of the TV in his bathrobe eating popcorn. There was no reason not to disturb him. I rang the doorbell. "Boyd," I said when he opened the door, "I got a power outage. Lend me a hand." He groaned, but then he tightened his cinch and came along, his good-naturedness working on him and kind of blacking out his good sense. "What are you doing up anyway?" I asked. "You ought to know," he said. "How do you expect a man to sleep once you climb through his window?" When he got in and saw the fuse box, he just stared at it. "What makes you think I can fix that?" he asked. "You're pretty handy, aren't you?" I said. He took a screwdriver and undid one of the wall fixtures, showed me the wires all burnt out behind the plug. "You got a few $1,000?" he asked. "Not precisely," I said. "God provides," I said. Boyd shook his head. "Always has," I said. "Problem with you, Boyd, is you don't give no heed to all the miracles around you." "I can't do nothing about that," he said. "I'm going home to sleep." "Wait a minute," I said. "Take a gander or two out in the garage." "I already know who's out there," he said. "I need to figure out how I went wrong," I said. "I'm afraid of what I'll see." I got him curious enough to come. I went into the garage first, waving the flashlight, he following. I looked around first at the socket and saw it was shot to hell. The frame-proof wall was still smoldering and toxic, so I had to stamp the sparks off it. The cord, too, was a hell of a mess. I followed it out slowly, slid the flash beam up the prophet's body. He was burnt all over, and Boyd's suit burnt off him, and the wires I had run around him sunk deep into his body now and probably held only feebly onto the bones. But I'll be damned if his one hand, which before had been down at his side, wasn't now raised up above his head. "Will you look at that?" I said. "What?" asked Boyd. He took the flashlight and went over to take a look at it, then looked at the shoulder joint, too. "There's a miracle if I ever saw one," I said. "Electricity must have done it," he said. "God did it," I said. "That's his holy sign to you, Boyd." Boyd turned around. What I could see of his face in the afterthrow of the flash beam contorted and tight. "You rigged it," he yelled. "Get thee behind me, Boyd," I reasoned. "Think it through and you'll hear what God is telling you." But all he wanted was to push past me and stamp on out. "Boyd," I yelled after him, "you gotta believe, you gotta believe. But not everybody deserves to be a prophet. Some people even God's miracles won't touch. Some people don't even listen to God when he hits them over the head." Thank you very much for bringing me this water. Appreciate that. Really, I guess as much as anything, that's a story about having a neighbor and the kind of neighbors you can have. Hopefully, most of you don't have neighbors that are like that. I'm going to talk just a little bit about this new novel coming out. Is the clock, I assume, is not right.
Is it quarter of eight? I think that's what
it must be wrong.
10:30.
Okay. This is a novel. It's coming out in September. It's about a religious leader who's involved in child abuse and is spraying, I think, a couple of things. One is my interaction with a crime novelist by the name of Andrew Vox, who is also a child abuse defense lawyer, who defends, defends children or also prosecutes people who've abused children, sues, you know, as an advocate for children, sues people who've been involved in their abuse. And I suppose the other thing is there was an article in the event some time ago that some of you might remember about child abuse in the Mormon Church. And I realized, you know, I grew up in Utah County and had a pretty happy life there in many ways. And then actually once I was grown up, I started realizing that these people I'd known, who I thought, you know, were having lives identical to mine, that many of them had been abused. And, you know, suddenly I found out that, you know, people that I thought I knew pretty well had been victimized and had been struggling with that in a way that I hadn't realized. So all those things kind of came together for me, and then also I realized that the Mormon Alliance was doing a case reports on child abuse, and that worked into it as well. And I'd thought about it while I was at BYU writing a book about something like this, and it didn't seem a possibility at BYU for obvious reasons. I didn't think that they would care for it. But then they did me the courtesy of objecting to my first book, Altman's Tongue, which was a cause of controversy. A student sent an anonymous letter to a general authority, and they sent it down the line and to the university at various stages. And I ended up getting asked to, if I stayed at BYU, not to write anything at all. They wanted me to change over into the literature department or the theory department, not be in the creative writing department per se. So I ended up leaving BYU, and suddenly the possibility was open for writing this book. I suppose I began with the question, how does religion create a space in which child abuse is allowed to continue? I think that's a critical question, and it's true not only of Mormonism, but many religions, I think, create a space, which is a kind of blind spot, which allows child abuse to go on and continue, and even protects unintentionally the people who are involved in abuse. And beginning with that, I wrote this book. I read a lot. I talked to different people, both in and out of the church, heard people's stories, and the book began to develop from there. And I think I came up with a few things that seemed important to me in terms of rethinking the way in which Mormonism handles child abuse. There have been some steps in Mormonism. There has been the establishing of the hotline for Mormon leaders on child abuse-related issues. But I think that's a very minor step. I think there's a lot more that could be done and a lot more that needs to be done. Over and over again, I heard from people when I'd talk to them about child abuse issues and we'd discuss it, and they'd say, well, yeah, that's true, but it's a minor problem. Only a few people are, you know, being affected or abused. And that might be true in a kind of, in a way, but, you know, if you're the person who's being abused, it's not a minor problem. And I think one of the difficulties the church has is that organizations tend to protect themselves. They have an institutional logic that they adopt, and very much have a lot of, want to protect themselves as institutions. And they don't, because of that, individuals take second role and end up being statistics rather than individuals. I think that's something that needs to be changed. I'm not sure how to change that. But the church makes its decisions often based on publicity and money. They've made decisions on child abuse, establishing the hotline because they were being sued for a lot of money. And other decisions have been made that way, rather than on morality. And I think we need to constantly remind ourselves as church members and constantly try to bring the church to a point where the decisions are being made on moral grounds. As far as I'm concerned, as long as there's even one person who's being abused either by family members or church leaders, there's more we can do. So anyway, I began with the question, how does religion create a space for child abuse? And one thing in Mormonism I think that's important is I heard numerous times growing up, if a church leader tells you to do something wrong and you do it anyway, you will be blessed. I think this is a terrible thing to say. This kind of emphasis on obedience opens up people to abuse. The other things I think we need to do is bishops need to know that they can't offer counseling on certain issues, that they're not trained to offer effective counseling. Bishops sometimes give very good advice, other times they give very bad advice. And I think bishops need to have enough training by the church to be able to know when they don't know enough to proceed on an issue. And I think there's other things we could bring. I really think that child abuse is something that needs to be acknowledged or brought to light. I think in some areas of the church it is, other areas it's not. I went to a ward meeting once, which was supposed to be a meeting about child abuse. And the interesting thing was the questions the ward members immediately started asking were not, how can we protect our children, but how can we defend ourselves from people who are accusing us of child abuse? There's this kind of fear that people are going to be accusing people of abuse. I think also, at least from my perspective living in Oklahoma, you need more and better trained social service people in certain areas, because you have people covering vast areas there, come in every 3 weeks. They're dramatically overworked, and they're not in a position sometimes to give the advice that they can give. So all those things kind of came together for me, and I decided finally to write this book. And it's a book from the perspective, part of it is from the perspective of a psychoanalyst, and part of it is from the perspective of the person involved in the abuse, the abusing church leader. And I think what I wanted to do more than anything is to reflect the apparatus that's in place and show by pursuing a case the way in which, how harmful it is and where the potential blind spots are. So I'm going to read you just a little bit of this and go from there and then decide, what to do. We can talk a little bit afterwards. I'm going to start by reading a little piece of preliminary case study that the psychoanalyst whose name is Festig does. When I first met him, Eldon Fox was a 38-year-old accountant as well as a lay provost for the largely conservative religious sect, the Corporation of the Blood of the Lamb, Bloodites. He was clean-shaven, pale in complexion, respectably dressed in a fashion typical of the church's leadership, wearing a dark, sturdy suit, a white shirt, and a conservative tie. In all our interviews, he never departed from this fashion of dress. He was a large, soft-spoken man, slightly overconscious of his body, but nevertheless possessed of a relaxed demeanor. He had sought treatment at the request of his spouse, who was concerned by recent changes in his sleep behavior, which included sleep in somebody else's voice, sleepwalking, and brief violent behavior towards his wife upon being awakened, behavior he had no memory of. Though Fox believed his wife was overreacting, he chose to come to me nonetheless for two reasons. First, to pacify her, and second, because during the past year he had had, quote, disturbing dreams and thoughts, unquote, which he, quote, wanted to be free of, unquote. In our first interview, Fox stated a preference for being called Brother Fox or Provost Fox or simply Fox, rather than being called by his first name, Eldon. He was initially reluctant to discuss his family history. The disturbing dreams and thoughts, he felt, had nothing to do with the past, since they had only originated a year ago. When I persisted, however, I discovered that he was the eldest of two children, the youngest having died at birth. This is actually the spurious biography that Fox is presenting to the therapist. He was brought up in the faith, growing up in a middle-class Bloodite family in a predominantly Bloodite neighborhood. His earliest memories included his young brother's funeral, presided over by his father, a provost for the church. He also remembered his mother helping him learn to read out of the official Blood-Eyed Children's magazine, Come Unto Me, at age 5, in the frequent absence of his father in his youth due to his church-related responsibilities. Fox remembered his mother as a proper, loving and industrious. She did not work outside the home. She was very meek and often would look to her husband for advice, even in simple household matters. The family had only one car, which Fox's father took every day to work. His mother spent most of her time at home, except Wednesday afternoon when a neighbor would drive her to the grocery store. Nevertheless, the mother gave her son no sign of being discontent. Even when she lost her youngest son, leaving Fox an only child, she told Fox that it had been God's will and quietly carried on with her life. He remembered his father as dignified, friendly, kind. His father was, Fox indicated, more often absent in the evenings. The family understood the reasons for this and respected him for it, drawing strength from his involvement with God. According to Fox, the time his father did spend with the family was, quote, quality time, unquote. His father, quote, governed the household with kindness, sometimes sternly, but never with anger, unquote, administering punishment swiftly and without heat. Fox sometimes thought of this, his father as being distant and withdrawn, but his mother explained that this was because of the weight of his position in the church. Both his mother and father are still alive and happily married. That gives you a little taste of the way in which he presents himself. And I'm going to read just a little piece of part later in the book. He kills a girl at one point, and he kills a girl that's in his congregation and presides at the girl's funeral. As the story progresses, he has a kind of hallucinated personality that he seems to talk to and interact with, which he calls Bloody Head, for reasons that I won't go into at this point, that argues with him and that convinces him that he hasn't done anything wrong and that encourages him to do certain things. And so I'm going to go ahead and just read the part of the funeral where he begins to hallucinate that Bloody Head has taken over. And there's also, he has another hallucination of two guys in business suits who seem to be carrying Bloody Head off. So there's a kind of interaction of this imaginary world of this narrator, along with what goes on with the actual facts of the narrative. And I hope that'll be easy enough to sort out. I don't know if it will. So this is from chapter 5. And this is not the voice of the therapist, but the voice of Fox, who is the F-O-C-H-S, who is the abuser. I meet the dead girl's parents in my office at the church just before the funeral service. I shake hands all around, offering condolences to each member of the family. These are always the most difficult deaths to accept, I say. Funerals for the young. It was not her time, but somebody chose to take her away from this life. And of course, it's him, but they don't know that. You can be sure that the guilty will be punished by God. The father nods, the rest of them too. The matter of the murderer is in God's hands, I say. You have to get past this. You cannot live on hate. You must live on love. There are questions likely never to be resolved for you about your daughter's death, questions for which neither you nor I will ever know the answer. You must let it go. The girl's mother, face tear-run, nods. The children and the father remain sullen. Funerals should be a happy time, I say, even in circumstances such as these. Do not forget that your daughter is with God. That's something to be happy about. We pray together, and I stand holding the door open, shaking their hands as they file past. My scriptures from the drawer, a knock comes from the window, from behind the curtains. I hold myself still, listen as the knock comes a second time, then a third. I part the curtains. Outside, his face pressed against the glass, is a man. I open the window, see the glass smeared with blood where his forehead was. Can I help you? I asked. He pulls his head straight, and I see there is an X hacked in his forehead. The hair of his head is shaved to the length of a day's growth of beard. His eyes are dark and penetrating, nervous. The question is, can I help you? He says. I don't think so, I say, and begin closing the window. He blocks me by placing his head in the gap. I can see all over the crown of his skull slits and streaks of blood, razor slashes. "Can it be you don't recognize me?" he asks. I go cold. I pull the window back and slam it against his head, opening the gash above his eye. The blood begins to drip onto the sill. "I take it you aren't happy to see me again." "I've never seen you before in my life." "How quickly we forget, he says. "The bus, Wednesday afternoon, and the woods before that," which is where the murder took place. I look at him, his torn shirt, his faded jeans. "No," I say, "you can't be." "I can," he says, "I am." "What happened to your clothes?" "What?" he says. He looks down at his body, tugs up his T-shirt. "One takes whatever's available. I assumed you and I were close enough it wouldn't matter." He looks back to me. "Or shall we say I'm traveling incognito," he says, "that I'm trying to avoid someone." "Avoid who?" "Aren't you going to invite me in?" he asks. "I have a funeral service to conduct," I say. "I'm here to help," he says. "There are things that should be said at this funeral. I'm just the man to say them." "You?" "Why not?" he says. "Invite me inside. You aren't dressed for a funeral." "This," he says, "don't worry about it. Nobody will mind." I stand staring out at him. "Invite me in," he says. "The people would much rather listen to me than to you." I stand hesitating, figuring my notes. "Do you really trust yourself not to slip?" he asks. "What are you going to feel when you see the casket?" "Come in," I say, "but only for a minute." He pushes the window fully open with his hand, then reaches out to me. I extend my hand, pull him onto the sill and through. "You can't stay long," I say. "Once I'm in, I'm in," he says. "Nobody tells me how long I can stay." He opens the door and goes out, ushering me before him. I step out and into the foyer, find it empty, the doors to the chapel proper shut. Opening these doors, he waves me in. The whole congregation is seated. They turn their heads as I enter, following me with their eyes as I walk up the aisle and onto the platform. The family is already seated on the stand. In front and to the side near the sacrament table is the casket, lid screwed down, gleaming. I can see my face in its skin. I cannot take my eyes away from the face, distorted and rippling. I feel a hand tighten upon my shoulder, on my arm, excuse me, the bloody-headed man tugging me toward the stand. "You see," he says, "you could never make it through the service without me." "I don't know," I say. "Sit up there and keep your mouth shut," he says. I let him drag me up the steps into my seat. I sit, heavy and awkward. "Where's the program?" he asks. I hand him the mimeographed half sheet of paper, a picture of Jesus in the open tomb on one side, the program notes on the other. He squints at it and approaches the microphone, taps on it. "Is this thing on?" he asks. After this, I don't know what happens. I know that he is speaking, can hear him utter phrases, can hear the individual words and tones, but the words do not seem to string together properly. He is babbling, and I am in dread of how I will be able to repair the damage. But as I wait, I realize that the audience seems to be swallowing his words well enough. They regard him intently and do not turn away. They do not seem displeased, and many are moved to tears by his words. They seem to hang on his every phrase. I turn to one side, touch the girl's father sitting next to me. "What's he saying?" I asked. "Can you make any sense of it?" The father does not seem to notice my touch. He stays still, his eyes welling with tears, watching the man with the blood-streaked head. I look around. People throughout the chapel are similarly transfixed. I watch it go on, the bloody-headed man speaking himself hoarse, the crowd fixing him in their attention with the utmost relentlessness. I look to the wall clock, watching the second hand spin slowly. I looked out the side window through marbled glass. A small dark shape is there on the outside where I know a bird is making a nest. I make a mental note to have the janitor remove it. I nudge the girl's father. "How long is he going to speak?" I ask. The father doesn't seem to notice me. "Does he know he isn't making any sense?" I shout into the father's ear. When there is no response, I turn again to Bloodyhead, listen carefully to his words. There are the words awful blood, among others, or it might be lawful blood, and redemption and love, but nothing that comes together in a piece in and of itself for me. I shake my head to clear it. It does not come clear. I look past him and see the gleaming lid of the coffin, a long narrow blur on it that I believe to be the remains of my face. As I examine it, it seems to me my face and body too, and myself and the girl in the woods. The doors at the back of the chapel swing to either side, and two men enter wearing dark suits and tinted glasses. The bloody-headed man at the pulpit stops abruptly, looks back at me, turns back to watch them come. They approach slowly, unnoticed by the crowd, one of them speaking into a cellular phone. Bloodyhead starts speaking faster, pounding his fist on the pulpit. The two come onto the stage, approaching him from either side. "I suppose this is your doing," says one of the men, pointing his finger at me. "Me?" I say. "Don't think you're getting away with anything," he says. The other man has holstered his telephone so as to strike the bloody-headed man in the face. The bloody-headed man grips the podium tightly, keeps speaking as the other man hits him again. His colleague does so as well. With their fists, they hammer his fingers until he can no longer hold to the podium. The audience seems not to notice. They knock him down. He keeps speaking. They take the bloody-headed man under the arms, drag him from the stand as he struggles, continuing with the speech well down the aisle. "Is this how you allow your guests to be treated?" he calls toward me. I stand to see him better. He breaks away an instant, darts for the podium, but is overwhelmed by the other two men before he arrives. They strike him a few times in the face and begin to drag him away down the aisle, backward, his heels flopping along the floor. "I'll see you later, Provost," he calls back to me. "Don't count on it," says one of the men in dark glasses. "You'll have to finish yourself," calls the bloody-headed man. "Don't say anything stupid. Speak in tongues of flame or not at all." They push the chapel doors open and leave. All of a sudden, I find myself before the podium, staring at the coffin, the image of my face. The crowd below seems restless. "Where was I?" I ask. "What was I saying?" The crowd pulls back visibly in their seats. A few of them begin to converse neighbor to neighbor, whispering among themselves, looking at me oddly. "Someone please tell me," I say. They remain silent. I realize I am holding a program of the meeting in my hand. I read aloud the first thing my eyes see. I sit down. The girl's father leans over, whispers into my ear, "You can't end the service yet." I have to get him to show me where on the program we are. I stand and announce shakily that the girl's brother will speak. I sit back in my seat, marking and holding with my thumb the next item on the program, the meeting dragging along, words labored and falling all around us until at last it is over.
Thanks.
If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
I'd be interested in some reactions of others to your first story.
Okay. It's a difficult story. I tend to think of it more of a story about neighbors. But yeah, I mean, it's a...
I'd be interested in how people refer to this. Have you read it to an LDS
audience? The first time I ever read it was to an LDS audience in New York. And I was very nervous about it. They responded very well. I'm sure that... I've read it a few more times since then. I'm sure there have been people in the audience who have been offended by the story. And, you know, it is a difficult thing. We don't really see prophets as...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, does anyone want to respond to that? Or? Yeah. I read it also in Texas to a Baptist group. And, well, most of the people there were Baptists. It was at a university. And the interesting thing is they saw more of their culture in it rather than Mormon culture. Yeah.
Did you have an intention of being humorous when you wrote the story?
Yeah. Yeah. that was the intention, is using this guy's voice, which is very convoluted, to work against itself. You know, it's partly a libertarian voice. It's partly a voice of a lot of people I grew up around. And, you know, there's this kind of unexamined, I think, things that people say. I just wanted to play that out and see where it went. So,
how did you know what
I can't answer that question. I don't even know how I know that. I knew someone who told me the story of they had to dig their father up for some reason, either to transfer. I can't remember why. It was to transport the body. Or some other strange reason. And they dug the body up and opened the coffin. And he said the amazing thing was that the face was perfectly preserved for just a moment, and then the air hit it, and then it just shriveled away. And so I, you know, you gather things from all over. You know, I don't know if the electrical
assumptions of that story are accurate or not. I didn't test that out. Well, that would have been a better idea. I didn't think about that. Yeah. So, any other questions? Yeah. Well, I don't have anything against Ezra Taft Benson. I do think that there were a number of years where he didn't do very much. I don't like his politics at all. I think once he was actually a church leader, those politics did not come out as much. Not church leader, church president. And when he was a church leader, actually, they were there. But once he was church president, we didn't see it as much, and so I felt like things went okay. I guess I do not like the way he gets used by certain groups. I don't like the kind of appeal to his political writings that certain groups take. And in that sense, I suppose I don't like him, but you know, I think he was a decent church president, as much as he could be, considering how ill he was. You think so? It's good. It might be, yeah, yeah. Gene?
It didn't seem to me a story meant about Ezra Taft Benson at all, but about current Mormon culture and the way that speaks and icons.
Yeah. I think I. Maybe. Yeah. I mean, he's the one that was the most obvious one to use, I suppose. But yeah, sure, you could have used other figures. Yeah. I mean, we really do have this weird appeal to the dead, and we iconize church leaders quite a bit, I think, despite our profession not to do that. And so, yeah, I think it's as much about a cultural milieu as it is about more than it is about Ezra Taft Benson. So, but I could still understand why people would not want to read a story where a prophet gets dug up. Yeah?
I was just wondering about that.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Yeah.
they may appreciate your craft, but
yeah.
I don't think you should act with open arms for someone.
No, that's certainly the case. Yeah. I left BYU rather than being fired, which was actually, I think, very therapeutic for me in some ways. It was pretty clear that I would be fired at some point. I think I could have stayed for a few more years. And it was also clear that they were really pressuring me not to write the kind of fiction I wanted to write. So it was therapeutic to leave. I'm still a church member. I'm not as actively involved in the church as I once was, but I still have connections there. But it is difficult. I think that one of the big difficulties for the church is that there is this kind of hostility towards art or artists among a lot of the members. People don't want to be challenged. That's true in the world as a whole, quite frankly. And, you know, there are, I think, a lot of church members who are very interested in art, but also there are a lot who just don't want to be challenged, don't want to have their beliefs threatened. And I tend to think it's productive to be made to think about things. You know, I grew up in Utah County, and I had a number of friends who never had to think about their beliefs. They went to BYU, they grew up in Utah County, and never were challenged about their beliefs. And then what they did is they went off to graduate school, and they immediately fell out of the church. And it was because they hadn't had a chance to think about their beliefs. They had never been challenged in a way that was productive. So I tend to think of that what I'm doing is important. I imagine a lot of people in the church, a lot of perhaps church leaders, think of me as kind of a horse fly on the horse that is the church. Yeah. Well, I started without any connection to the church, and I think I've had a period where it's become more important in some ways. But at the same time that I've been writing this stuff, I write You know, I've published a number of stories that, that have really no collection of the church in the last year or so.
The abuser is not identified as a if we're trying to make points about the church, and yet we're inventing some other...
I'll tell you why I did that. I started out with this book as a Mormon book, with the abuser identified as a bishop, and the church identified as the Mormon church. But then as I began to do more research and look into things, I realized it was a problem that was very pervasive in a number of religions. And that what I wanted to do, I think anyone who reads this book who's Mormon is going to see it as Mormon. That's the stuff I know the best. I was in a bishopric, so I could see the potential for abuse in direct Mormon practices. And so all the details really are Mormon. But I wanted someone who didn't know much about Mormonism to be able to pick it up and see it as relevant to their own experience, and not see it as a book that you know, they could use as a, as you know, as an attack on the church, I suppose. So I did it to try to expand the range of the book in some senses. But at the same time, I think these, you know, very serious issues in Mormonism, I think the Mormon audience is already going to be prone to read it as Mormon because of the way they've responded to my other books. So, but it's tricky. I mean, I went back and forth on that. Didn't know quite what to do. Yeah.
I've noticed that in Altman's Tongue, you also have a story about an abuser. And that story was also written in the perspective of the abuser.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you find that difficult.
Very difficult. I think I'm good at it. But it's also, it's very draining. The Munich window story is very difficult to write, really draining. And this book as well, I mean, it's very, very hard to enter into that kind of perspective. And you have to have, I think, pretty solid anchors in your life to be able to explore that. The reason I did this from the perspective of the abuser is because it allowed me to see more of the system of the church and the way in which it was creating the gaps. And I think there are a number of good you know, narratives of written from the perspective of the person who's been abused. And so I felt like this was a way of filling another gap. So, yeah. Well, no, I think there's a certain amount of, there's some qualities. I don't know if you'd exactly like him, but he, you know, I think there are some human qualities to him as well. And I mean, it's, I think as the narrative goes on, it's clear that, you know, he didn't spring out into this just ex nihilo, that there's other factors that have pushed him to this. But, you know, I still take the line. I think certain people reach a point when they're, you know, I think a lot of abusers are savable, I suppose, that they can be rehabilitated in one way or another. I think a number of others, though, are not. You reach a point where you're not, or where it's not worth the time of society to save you. And, I mean, that maybe is an extreme view, but the other thing I found is reading, you know, first-hand accounts of abusers and things is they're very persuasive. They you know, they always have reasons for why they didn't, you know, why this happened and why in some ways they shouldn't be blamed, and they're always very apologetic. But you know, a lot of them go back and do the same thing again. And I think at some point you just have to say, all right, we're going to keep you in jail for the rest of your life. So. Well, it's a hotline. Someone might know better than I do about this. It's a hotline that's for the bishops and stake presidents, the leaders, so that if they have someone come in to them with a child abuse-related matter, they call the hotline up and get advice from people. I don't know. Do you? I think it's probably social services, yeah. I don't know. It's not social services? Who is giving the advice? So in essence, the hotline is there for legal advice rather than for. That's interesting. Yeah.
But there are also handbooks
for
giving emotional.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a primary
president. Right. Right. I think it's, I mean, I really think, too, though, that a big part of the problem has been bishops have decided, okay, I have this guy come in, and
And he's abused his kids, but he's a good guy, and he's going to, you know, he's promised not to do it again. And there's a lot of assumptions about repentance or about how easily someone can get out of a cycle of abuse that certain bishops have that I think are just absolutely incorrect. And so I think we need more training. I think some of these, you know, most of these matters bishops need to know that they just don't know enough to make judgments on these cases, that they need to go to someone who's had intensive training. Yeah. I think it's more. I did feel. You mean you're talking about the? There's another first person narrator in the novel, of a therapist as well as the abuser, and that for me was served as a kind of balance. I mean, I could go back to that. Yeah. I don't know. I suppose in an abstract way I did. I mean, I also saw. What was difficult was getting inside of the voice, I suppose, and then, you know, essentially when you're writing another voice, you're accepting into your mind, you know, another person in a way, and it's very difficult because you want to keep that contained, and, you know, there's a logic that goes along with that, and so it's difficult to kind of cope with, I suppose. I don't think I felt much sympathy. I felt a certain amount of compassion, so... Yeah, we can do one more question and then we've got to go. Any final question? Thank you for coming.